Chapter 15. The house where Sally lived was in Musgrave Crescent, facing common land that was known as Eel Brook Common. Musgrave Crescent was higher than the surrounding land, and some know-it-all in a local pub had told her that it was built on what was originally a Bronze Age mound. The mound could have been a military fortification or a burial site, and Sally always hoped it was the former. The same know-it-all had told her that in the 1880s, Fulham FC had played their home games there, and that during the Second World War, an underground bunker was built to protect local residents from German bombers. The common was bordered by several roads, including Effie Road to the north, New King's Road to the southeast, Musgrave Crescent to the northeast. Sally normally walked along Effie Road, past her favourite tapas restaurant, El Metro, and into the common. Musgrave Crescent was to the left. The road was about 4 or 5 feet higher than the common, and access was barred by a wall topped by railings. She had to walk about 100 yards to a ramp that led up to the road. It was an easy walk, but it was the obvious route, so instead she headed south to Farvart Road. She walked along the road, then doubled back to check that she wasn't being followed before walking across the grass. There was a children's play area to her right, and mothers were grouped together chatting as their kids ran and played. There was a group of dog walkers off to her left, deep in conversation as their charges romped around. Ahead of her, a group of kids were kicking a football around. She approached Musgrave Crescent at the midway point. Her flat was to the left, but she went right, checking the cars that were parked there. She reached the end without seeing an outlander, so she turned and retraced her steps, eventually arriving at the white-fronted terrace that she had lived in for the past 18 months. It was built over 3 stories, including a basement with its own entrance. It had originally been a single home, but over the years most of the houses in the road had been converted into flats. Sally lived on the first floor. Her bedroom overlooked the small back garden and had an original cast iron fireplace, which the landlord had said wasn't to be used. She had 2 flatmates, and they all had individual contracts with the landlord, a fast-talking Indian man who owned more than 2 dozen properties in Fulham and Chelsea. Sally had only met him 2 times, and each time he had turned up in a bright green Lamborghini. Business was obviously good. Sally continued to walk parallel to the road, still checking cars, her breath caught in her throat as she spotted the black outlander. It was parked behind a white van, so she hadn't seen it until she had moved down the road. There didn't appear to be anybody in the vehicle, so she walked along the grass until she could see the registration plate. She couldn't remember the number of the car that had followed her in the Uber, so she reached for her phone to check the pictures she had taken, and then mentally kicked herself when she remembered that she'd given her iPhone away. It looked like the same model as the one that had been outside the Wimbledon house. But then there were probably hundreds of black Mitsubishi Outlanders in London. She drew level with the car. There was no way of telling if it belonged to her pursuers or not, and staring at it wasn't going to help. And if it was them, where were they? She walked along to the end of Musgrave Crescent. There was a black BMW SUV and a black Honda CRV, but no Outlanders. She walked back through the common and stopped at the Mitsubishi again. She couldn't see a resident's parking permit from where she was, but that didn't mean there wasn't one on the windscreen. The only way to find out would be to go onto the pavement, but that would mean walking up the ramp and exposing herself. She stared at the house. She heard a voice shouting off to her right, and she flinched, but it was one of the kids calling for the ball. As she looked back at the road, she recognised a figure walking along the pavement towards the house from the direction of the tube station. It was Callum Jenkins, her flatmate. He had worked for an estate agency in Kensington before he had been let go the previous month. Now he was unemployed, which explained why he was returning to the flat in the middle of the day. He pretty much depended on handouts from his parents and had the smallest of the 3 bedrooms, paying £100 a month less than Sally. The third flat sharer was Laura, a girl who worked as a waitress at a local burger restaurant while she applied for jobs in journalism. As usual, Callum was wearing Beats headphones connected to his phone. She wanted to attract his attention, but he was too far away, and even if she called out, he wouldn't hear her over the sound of his music. He walked up to the front door and let himself in. Sally's heart was racing. Even if her pursuers had found her road, there was no way they would be able to get into her flat, was there? It was fitted with a Bannum alarm and security locks. He'd be fine. At least, that's what she said to herself. She stared up at the first floor windows. The sitting room overlooked the street, and that was where they spent most of the time when they weren't in their bedrooms. It was comfortably furnished with two leather sofas and a big screen TV. It even had a Bang & Olufsen music centre that Callum had brought with him. She counted off the seconds as she pictured Callum climbing the stairs, then taking out his keys and opening the double locks. Once the door was open, he'd walk into the hall and tap the four-digit passcode into the burglar alarm console. Then he'd probably go into the kitchen and switch on the kettle. Callum was a big tea drinker. Tetley tea bags, milk, and two sugars. She jumped as something flashed in the front room window, then flashed again. There was no sound, but she knew immediately what had happened. Someone had just shot Callum with a suppressed weapon. The sound hadn't carried outside the room, but the flashes told the whole story. She put her hand over her mouth and blinked away tears. She felt the strength drain from her legs, and she grabbed at the railings for support. Behind her, a woman was calling for her dog. Sally stared at the window. A dark figure appeared. Then just as quickly, it moved away. They were waiting for her in her flat. But how? How did they know where she lived? She took long, slow breaths, trying to calm herself down. She felt as if she was trapped in some weird dream, and part of her wondered if at some point she was going to wake up and she'd realize that she was safe and warm in her own bed. She gripped the railing so tightly that the knuckles of both her hands whitened. This was no dream. She looked over her shoulder. There were no pursuers, just nice, middle-aged, middle-class people walking their pampered pets and teenagers kicking a ball around without a care in the world. High overhead, an airliner was heading towards Heathrow. Everything was going on as normal around her. She shook her head, trying to clear her thoughts. She had ditched her phone and her watch, so there was no way they could have tracked her to Fulham that way. She was pretty much certain that no one had followed her on the bus, or when she went to the charity shop for the change of clothes. They hadn't followed her across the common. They had already been waiting for her. That meant that they knew who she was and where she lived. And that could only mean that it was someone within MI5 who was after her. Was Ian Hadley behind this? Or was he only obeying orders? Had something happened? Something so terrible that everyone involved had to disappear? Her grip tightened on the railings. That made no sense. Sally was a footie. She wasn't involved with any active investigations. No one at the house was. They bought stuff. They looked after flats and houses. They updated social media. They were the lowest of the low. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. That made them worth killing. She let go of the railings, her mind racing. She needed somewhere to hide, somewhere she would be safe while she worked out what to do next. She was a sitting duck, standing outside her home. She backed away, then turned and walked across the common. She took out all the keys she had in her bag. The three MI5 properties that she was supposed to visit that day were clearly no longer safe, not after her pursuers had turned up at the house in Kingston. There were three sets of keys on her personal keyring. There were keys to her flat, which was clearly a no-go area. Then there were the keys to her parents' house in Croydon. If they knew her home address, there was every chance they also knew where her parents lived. Her heart began to race, and she stopped in her tracks. What if they had already gone there? She felt as if a steel belt had been strapped around her chest, and for a few seconds, she fought to breathe. What if they were there now, waiting with guns, like they were waiting at her flat? And if they were there, what had happened to her parents? Her heart was pounding, and she stood rooted to the spot, gripped by a rising sense of panic that threatened to overwhelm her. "Pull yourself together," she hissed to herself. "Get a fucking grip on yourself." She took a deep breath, held it, and then let it out slowly. There was no point in worrying about what might or might not have happened. She had to take what was happening one step at a time. And the first step was to find somewhere to rest up. A hotel, maybe? She could check into a hotel while she worked out what to do next. Except, if they could track her phone, they might also have access to credit card records, and almost all hotels would insist on seeing a debit or credit card. She could use a card that went with one of the legends she looked after, but she had no way of knowing any more if they were safe. She looked back at her key ring. The third key was a Yale, and she frowned at it for several seconds before she remembered what it was for. It was the key to Tim's flat. He had pretty much insisted that she had a key to his place, and during the last 2 months of their relationship, had been pleading with her to move in with him. She'd always kept her own place, and had never given him a key, even though he had dropped several heavy-handed hints that he wanted one. He lived in a one-bedroom flat in Maida Vale, above a corner shop close to the tube station. His parents had helped him with a large deposit, and he just about managed to pay the mortgage on his police sergeant's salary. But he was dependent on getting regular overtime. Sally had never told anyone at MI5 about the relationship, and she had met him after she had joined and been positively vetted. She looked at the key, wondering if Tim had changed the lock after she had left. She smiled to herself. No, he wanted her back. He'd made that clear from the start. He didn't ask for the key back, or ask her to return any of the gifts he'd given her. He wasn't the type. Tim was a genuinely nice guy, and the way things stood, maybe the only person she could trust. But first, she needed to get to Maida Vale. The number 28 bus went from Fulham Town Hall to the end of Elgin Avenue and took about half an hour, if the traffic was good. Or she could take the 414, which went down Edgware Road. She'd made the trip more than 100 times while she had been going out with Tim. She always preferred to spend the night in his flat rather than having him stay over at hers. She'd always said it was because she didn't want her flatmates eavesdropping on them. But the real reason was that she was fiercely protective of her personal space and knew that if Tim did stay over, it wouldn't be long before he started leaving clothes and toiletries in her room. And she wasn't ready for that. Not yet, and maybe not ever. But as things stood, Tim's flat was probably the only place where she would be safe.